Namaste. Good morning, everyone. Happy Diwali and a very happy new year to you. For those who may not know, Diwali is the festival of light. The light of divine wisdom. There is a very sweet story circulating. I think it happens every Diwali, where Lord Krishna's charioteer is waiting patiently for him to arrive, to come onto the chariot. And he keeps waiting and keeps waiting. And Krishna seems to be taking a lot of time. So he's quite perplexed because Krishna is usually very punctual. So he goes inside and sees that Krishna is taking his time to get dressed, trying on different crowns, different pieces of jewelry, seeing what looks nice or doesn't look nice. And so the charioteer asks him, "My Lord, where are we going that you are taking so much trouble to get dressed?" And Krishna says, "We are going to meet Duryodhan." Duryodhan is perhaps the chief antagonist of the Mahabharata war. So the charioteer is shocked. He said, "For him, all this trouble of getting dressed in your finery is for him?" And Krishna says, "What to do? Duryodhan only sees the outside. He doesn't see who I am on the inside. And so therefore, I'm trying to look my best for him." The charioteer is very upset. He says, "How can you, Lord Krishna, go to meet Duryodhan? He must come to you. I can't believe this, that not only I was waiting patiently outside, now you inform me that I am supposed to take you, the Lord, to Duryodhan. What kind of behavior is this, my Lord?" And Krishna replied, he said, "My child, you have to understand one fundamental truth. It is the light that goes to the darkness. The darkness does not come to the light. Therefore, I must go. The light of wisdom, the light of spiritual teachings finds its way. The light finds its way to the sincere devotees and seekers. The darkness refers to the darkness of the ego, embroiled in the sense of doership, thinking it is in control of its life, embroiled in the sense of separation, and all the attributes that come with that sense of separation. Hatred, malice, judgments, jealousy, arrogance, pride, and so on and so forth. It may appear that we find our way to spiritual teachings and spiritual teachers, but the truth is, it can only happen if it is the divine will that a particular person, a particular individual, at some point on their life's journey, based on their life's experiences, is drawn to the light. And so an occasion like Diwali is to acknowledge and accept the grace of consciousness to have brought us at least so far on our life's journey. There are two things I would like to read out. One is a bit peculiar because a thought was coming to me for the last few days to read out a very brief exchange of when Shirdi Sai Baba was taken to the court, dragged to court, because a thief was found with jewels, and he said when he was caught that Sai Baba had given it to him. Actually, this was quite strange because I don't know where this thought was coming from, and I found why is this thought coming? I'll have to dig this reference out, and so on. The mind starts questioning. And I said to myself, let it just pass, you know. Maybe it was a memory which came up of this incident. Let it go. And strangely, yesterday I was reading a book gifted to me by a devotee of Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi. It is based on the lives of the devotees of Bhagwan. And in the very early pages, there was the story of one Perumal Swami, who was like almost like a protector and bodyguard of Bhagwan when he was young. And these are one page descriptions of the lives of the devotees, one or two pages, sometimes three. And at the end of this story, I read how Perumal Swami, being so close to Bhagwan, dragged Bhagwan to the court. So you can call it a divine coincidence. And I said to myself last night that I must find this reference of Shirdi Sai Baba being drawn to court and read it out. So here's the brief exchange. So, as I said, Bhagwan is, Shirdi Sai Baba is dragged to the court, and his devotees try to impress upon the judge that you can't bring a figure like this to the courtroom. First of all, he has hundreds of devotees and they all will come and there'll be chaos and pandemonium. So the judge says, all right, I'll send the commissioner to him. Point noted. So the commissioner asks him, what is your name? And he replies, Sai Baba. What is your father's name? Also Sai Baba. What is your guru's name? Venkusa. What is your creed or religion? Kabir, the mystic Kabir. What is your caste or race? Parvardigar, which is Vishnu, which is consciousness. My caste or race is consciousness. What is your age? Hundreds of thousands of years. Will you solemnly affirm that what you are going to say is the truth? Absolute truth. Do you know the accused? Yes, I know him, as I know everyone. The man says he is your devotee and that he lived with you. Is that so? Yes, I live with everyone. All are mine. Did you give him jewels as alleged by him? Yes, I did give him. But who gives what and to whom? The commissioner. If you gave him the jewels, how did you get them and become possessed of them? Everything is mine. Baba, here is a serious charge of theft. The man says that you delivered the jewels to him. What is all this about? What the devil have I got to do with all of this? And this goes on till further investigation shows that the accused actually did not visit Shirdi on that day. And so the case against Sai Baba was dropped. Quite a beautiful exchange. So it was meant to be shared, and it has been shared in that spirit. Diwali is also of significance as far as Rameshji is concerned. Because when he was asked once that was there ever an event which confirmed to him that awakening had happened under the grace of Nisargadatta Maharaj. You see, quite peculiarly, Rameshji was one of those few who had a very good Nadi astrology reading, in which it mentioned that he would be with the Guru for 30 years, over 30 years. But it would not amount to much. And then after retirement, he would meet a Guru, and the results would be very quick. Those are the words he would use. The results would be very quick. So, one Diwali, Maharaj gave a talk at Mularpatan's house, who was a translator. And Rameshji was translating because Mularpatan had to look after the arrangements and the guests. And it was on that day that what Rameshji said was that even before Maharaj could finish his sentence, the translation was happening. In other words, Rameshji knew what Maharaj was going to say, and it was spontaneously coming out. And at that time, he knew that something had happened. That was it. No flashlights going off, no major visions happening, something as simple as that. And in fact, when I spoke to Mularpattan, I used to visit him on Sunday afternoons and keep him company in his old age. He mentioned the same thing, that yes, this is what had happened on Diwali at my home. I'd like to read out this other note which someone sent, whose question was answered in an earlier talk, which comes from, this story comes from the Eastern European tradition. So basically it begins with the Lord in church saying he wants to relax a bit. He wants the day off. And so the monk Seraphim, I hope I pronounced that name right, says, don't worry, I'll take your place for the day, and you go and relax. You must be quite tired listening to all this babbling which people come and do in church. So the Lord said, all right, but I will take the day off on only one condition. You have to keep your mouth shut. So Seraphim said, is that all? Okay, I'll go up on the cross and keep my mouth shut. You leave the church, enjoy yourself, and come back. So here goes. In came a rich man, and while he was praying, he dropped a bag full of money. Seraphim wanted to warn him, but he remembered his vow to Jesus and said nothing. Soon enough, in came a poor man. He started praying, but saw the bag from the corner of his eye. Since nobody was around, the poor man grabbed the bag and left. Seraphim wanted to tell him not to take the money because it didn't belong to him. But after all, he had made a vow to the Christ. So he said nothing. Then in came a young man asking the Lord for protection, since he was embarking on a long sea trip. Suddenly, the rich man came back into the church with the guards, saying that he had left the bag of money there. The young man was the only one in the church, and therefore the guards arrested him. Now, right here, Seraphim could not hold himself any longer, and he shouted out from above, he is innocent. Imagine the scene. Imagine the bewilderment of everyone. The guards, the rich man, and the young man. And because everyone heard the voice of God, they released the young man. They finally managed to arrest the poor man who had taken the money and forced him to return it to the rich man. Now, when Christ came back, he wasn't happy. He said, this is not good. I told you to shut up. But Seraphim exclaimed, I prevented injustice from happening. Then the Lord said, no, Seraphim, you have got it all wrong. You had vowed to shut up. You promised me. But by speaking, you interfered with my will. That rich man was going to do evil deeds with the money, and I made him lose it. The poor man needed the money and I let him find it. And the young man is now drowning after his ship sank. Had he gone to prison, he would have survived. Even though you are a monk rich in spirituality, God's will takes care of things better than us. Even when it seems that they are going wrong. And that is why Rameshji would say, do not give advice unless asked for. Because you don't know better than God. And more importantly, to label something as having gone wrong is a subtle judgment. Every now and then I receive a mail where a person says, I don't understand the teaching much, yet I'm drawn to it. Does it mean that it is not meant for me? This is a very important point to explore. And for any spiritual teaching or spiritual teacher, it surely comes up. Some people are drawn to a particular teaching and teacher, but may not understand much of what is being said. Yet they feel that pull. And this depends on the feeling. Since the thinking is not operating beyond a point, the analysis, the intellect, whatever word you give it, the feeling, not the visual appearance of the teacher, or the surroundings of the teacher, the environment, not these physical attributes, the feeling. A friend of mine who's a therapist, one day, our offices are very close together, so I was a bit free and I went over to his place for a cup of tea. And I was admiring his shirt. It had these blue, red, and yellow stripes. I said, oh, what a lovely shirt you're wearing. And he said, because today I have no clients. So I said, what do you mean? What is the connection between the shirt and you not having any clients? And he replied, so there is no projection. So there is no outward projection. And I said, wow, that's so beautiful. He said, so usually when I have clients, I wear plains, subtle colors, and not something which catches the eye, so to speak. So coming back to this feeling, because feeling is not something dependent on what one sees. Partially maybe, not totally. What one feels in the presence of a teaching or teacher, what one feels. And that feeling will be felt even with eyes closed. No matter how strange it might sound, let us consider the most common, one of the most common analogies. Words cannot exist if it weren't for the space between them. Imagine writing a word on a piece of paper. What gives meaning to the word which is written is the paper on which it is written on, the space within the alphabets, the space between the alphabets, create something that is recognized as a word because one has been taught that A for apple, B for banana, and so on. The mind has been taught A, B, C, D. For a mind and a child not given this education, that line on the paper would have no meaning. So, which is more important? The line on the paper or the space around that line, the curvy line which takes the shape of what we call alphabets, which enables them to be recognized? Which is more important, the word or the unmanifest, the space that allows this word to be recognized as a word, which we take for granted? Because the focus is on the projection, which is the A, B, C, D. One might find that one comes in touch with the teaching which perhaps does not make too much sense at the moment, but one finds one is drawn like a moth to the flame. One finds a sense of either a gentle peace being in this presence or a burning intensity to keep coming back and back and back to this presence. One is resonating with the presence. It is not just the words. It is never just the words. It cannot be just the words. It is impossible. And that presence can provide nothing except peace. If one does not feel a sense of peace and one does not resonate with the words, then perhaps one can ask oneself, what am I really getting here? I don't know. Before we move on to any questions, if anyone might have or would like to share something, one more aspect of this teaching which struck me because of Diwali, and also because I was reading this book on Bhagwan's devotees, was when Bhagwan's mother was passing away, and for over 8 hours, Bhagwan put his left hand on the mother's forehead and the right hand on her chest. And when he was asked what he was doing, I can't read out the exact line because it's lying below the laptop as a prop. But I'd love to read it out. So he said, all the possible tendencies that could arise are being submerged into the spiritual heart. All the possible tendencies that could arise and arise and arise were forever being silenced. Liberation, which he gave his mother. Now, this is what the great teachings do. that in our daily living, in our own lives, what perhaps was a previous pattern, with the light of this teaching, seeing through different eyes, so to speak, one does not fall into the conditioned pattern trap anymore. For example, earlier you were blaming people. Now, with the full understanding that no one is really to blame, this tendency of a finger-pointing approach drops. Possible tendencies drop away. The result? Peace of mind. That is the gift of the teachings, you see. It's a very powerful gift. It is eliminating the cartwheels of the thinking mind, so that they don't reincarnate moment after moment after moment in one's daily living. And the measure, one finds one is more at peace now than ever before. I don't know if we have a glitch. I hope everyone can see me and hear me. I would like to show you all this memory came up because we have a school group, a school WhatsApp group. So I was in a Jesuit school called Campion. And we had a motto, a Latin motto. I hope you all can hear me. And the Latin motto was Gaudium in Veritate. I don't know if I pronounced it properly, but I'll show you the emblem. And why I'm mentioning this. It's quite unbelievable how the truth follows you, you know. Just allow me a moment to find this. Yes. I don't know if you all can see the words below the emblem. Gaudium in Veritate. Nobody taught us in school, at least I don't remember what this means. It was thanks to Google I found out it means joy and truth. You can Google it for yourselves. I mean, we weren't taught this joy and truth in school, but it's so beautiful to know that at least the school had this as a motto. One more thing to add is that on the weekend of December 12th and 13th, I think that's a weekend. I hope I've not mixed up the dates. I will be in Goa and an informal gathering is planned for the weekend. If any of you all are in Goa, it is going to be a very small, intimate, just sharing of space in an outdoor environment. And so you can get in touch with the team if you happen to be there and if you'd like to join us with the appropriate social distancing norms and so on and so forth. But I have requested that it be just very few of us. All right. Okay. Yes, Holger.
Thank you, Gautam.
Good to see you again.
Thank you. I feel very fortunate, and all my teachers are very beautiful.
Uh-huh. As within, so out.
And it's so amazing. I don't know since how long, but I feel so much love. I mean, it's just gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you, Harun. Thank you. All right. I don't see any other raised hands. I think I'm getting a bit used. Taking me time with this new laptop. That means I get to see more Holger, is it, until someone else comes along?
You want me to say something?
Not at all. You see, Holger is very strange. In social gatherings, it's so peculiar when there's silence, people feel so uncomfortable, you know, because it's not the norm. And so often I found myself being quiet at a social do or at a dinner table where there are people around. And the next morning I would get a call from common friends saying, oh, you were so unfriendly, you were so quiet. And, you know, it created a lot of confusion in the younger years because that was not the intent. The intent was not to be unfriendly or be perceived as a snob. One was just being the way one was. But the social conditioning overlaid all these concepts onto, you know, you were this, you were that, you were this. And it's quite amazing that how silence is really generally not perceived to be normal, at least in a social context. But thankfully, those on the spiritual path, on the spiritual journey, have a taste of the potency of this silence, even when it comes to a social gathering. That's the beauty of it. So I thought I'll just share that with you. And it's true, silence is golden. Silence is literally golden. The purity of gold, and gold as the light of the divine, which is the seventh chakra, which is gold, the thousand petal lotus, which is the zone of silence, you could say. And silence is truly golden. Beautiful, beautiful. Okay. Okay, thank you, Holger. Yes, Rahul.
Good morning, Gautam.
Good morning. Seeing you after some time.
Yeah, actually the time got changed here in Europe. So I missed a couple of sessions thinking that it was going to be 7 o'clock at my time, but it was earlier. So I always joined after the session was over and I caught you up. Yeah, I was just, it was a sudden memory of a video that came of Osho, who said, it's a very famous video also, it has millions of views. It says, oh my God, there is no God, or something like that.
Right.
And he says, so I was just wondering whether he was trying to shake people by saying that, or was it, what could have been his...
Well, for that, we'll have to ask him. But you see, the thing is, Rahul, we generally consider God as an individual because we are individuals. So we project that onto a higher power and then we place all these attributes, all powerful, all merciful, etc., to this perfect being called God. And many masters, not only in the Indian traditions, but in Western traditions, in the Sufi tradition, they seek to bring down this image, you see, because God as the totality, as consciousness, as the formless consciousness, as Shiva that has become Shiva Shakti, the living presence, that God, that is what they are trying to point at. Not this projected image of an individual passing judgment that you should be this way and you should not be that way and so on and so forth. So there is no God in that sense, according to me, is what is being implied. But Osho has said elsewhere in some of his works, that the whole journey is about, I mean, you saw how much he was influenced by the Buddha.
Yeah.
He considered the Buddha God. And so what he was trying to point at is all this, after all, he was a disruptor in that sense. Osho was a disruptor. So he was doing it across the board, you see. So that is, according to me, what was being pointed at, that these notions we have been brought up with and conditioned by of God, that is not the God being referred to in these teachings. And that is the beauty of Advaita, you see. It is talking about the living God, consciousness, the presence, the force, the Shakti. It brings it down to here and now, in this moment. That is the beauty of it.
Thank you, Gautam. It's so nice to see you and ask you a question after so long.
Thank you. You're in Germany, right?
I'm in Germany, yeah.
Are things okay there with the virus situation? Because I've heard in France and the UK, it's not too good.
Germany's handling it better than other countries.
Okay.
But cases are increasing because of the winter beginning. Yeah.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Namaste.
So I really enjoy reading your books and some ancient Vedanta scriptures, and they're very helpful. But recently I see there is an urge to, I get a kick out of reading them. And when I want to reflect and meditate, after like a few minutes, I'll still want to go at the book and read it and, you know, almost like get all of it. And then I was just wondering, can this love for reading become like a trap? And what should be the ratio of reading, non-duality, and sitting in silence and actually internalizing and reflecting, and how to get the balance right?
That's quite sweet. Kumar, the thing is, if one is enjoying reading and one is not laboring the process, if one is enjoying it, there's no harm at all. You see, the problem comes in if I'm trying to achieve something by reading and I get frustrated because I'm not getting it. And I go back to reading and reading and reading. That is, then it becomes a lot of doership which causes suffering. But supposing I have read a page which I truly have loved. Like, for example, I have a habit of underlining. You know, so I've read so many books where I've underlined. And I like to go back and read what I have underlined. And it's a joy. You know, some things I'll read, some I won't. But as long as the process is one which is not being done out of a stress of, you know, oh, I better read this again and again and again. That burden is not there. It is fine because you like something, you read it. And it could also be that you've understood a bit of it and you want to understand more of it. What is the feeling behind the reading? That has to be looked at. So as I always say, this teaching does not say what is right and what is wrong and what you should do and what you should not do. Okay. Also, some people are not really built to be in silence. That does not mean they are not silent people. For example, my own teacher, you could not go to him and just sit in silence. He would love to talk. You see, he was a banker. He was a man of the world in his younger days. He was a bodybuilder. So he liked to engage in conversation. You could not just go and, you know, request him for one-on-one silent sitting, because he just enjoyed wanting to know about your life and how has the teaching impacted your life. So that's the way he was built. Now, someone else, for example, like Eckhart, it was the opposite. It was very evident that his preference was to not speak. So many times, you know, when he was in India, especially, if we were in the car together, there was no conversation. So it is a very, it's something inbuilt, you know, how one is. So there's also not this necessity to stay in silence to absorb the teaching, because it's not about that. It's about how one feels on the inside. And more importantly, the thinking mind, is that silenced? You know, so I would not really say as a practice, it is a must to sit in silence. However, I would like to add that Maharaj is absolutely right. He would encourage people to meditate, to sit and abide in their being, because he knew that we were so conditioned to keep constantly thinking about what's going on in our lives, at work, in the world, that rarely did we give ourselves the chance to just sit and be. So he would also say, sit for an hour, sit for 2 hours maybe, but just abide in your being, because what will happen is that what then happens while one sits in silence is that it permeates into the other hours of the day. Now, it could also be that sitting in silence, thoughts are still going on. It doesn't mean that there'll be no thoughts, but what then happens is that throughout the day, even the witnessing that a lot of thoughts are happening will start happening. Because in meditation, in sitting in silence, we have now given ourselves the opportunity to be aware that there are a lot of thoughts passing on and over our screen of consciousness. When this permeates daily living and the waking hours, the quality of witnessing starts happening more and more. So we are not running away with the various thoughts which are coming up. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay. Yes, Priyam. Hello.
Hi, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. First of all, I would just like to thank you for the space. When I connected last month, I think I was in a very different mental and emotional space, and now suddenly things are changing. I'm connecting more, and so many new things are happening, which are like just blessings, and I just cannot bring myself to believe that all of this is truly happening. So I can see the practical changes the teaching has brought into my life. So thank you so much for that. And my question is that my personal experience is that there is a lot of acceptance and compassion for everything and everyone. When I really sit and look inside, there is absolutely no grudges and no anger or anything towards anyone. But I'm kind of like struggling with that flowing over to myself. Like, I sort of struggle with the acceptance for myself. What I perceive as I did something wrong. And then I kind of sort of get into this critical, over-judgmental thing about myself. Like for others, I'm like, it was meant to be this way, and this was God's will, and nobody is really doing anything, and they cannot help being that way. But when it comes to my own self, I'm kind of still struggling. Like, I feel a detachment for my own thing, not feeling like that for myself, not accepting myself and my own actions. Instead of being in acceptance, I become like, no, I could have done that better, and I cannot stop thinking about it. So how do I don't know if self-love is the right word to use here, but yeah, how do I see myself as a manifestation of that same consciousness?
But you see, Priyam, even that judgment of oneself is because we love ourselves. I'll give you an example, a different example of someone who told me that she runs an office with 100 people. And so when they hire the staff, and the staff turn out to be very good performers, and she interviews the workers herself, okay? So when they turn out to be very good performers, she's very happy. There's a lot of pleasure, but there's no pride that I hired the right person, okay? But if someone is hired who turns out to be inefficient, who turns out to be not as good as she had hoped for, she blames herself. I hired the wrong person. someone like me with so much experience being a businesswoman, how could I hire this person? So she blames herself for hiring a staff member who didn't work out well and does not take the credit for hiring a staff member who worked out well. You see? So it is exactly what you are also saying, that in a sense, that it, you know, to blame oneself and judge oneself happens more naturally than judging others and blaming others. And this is because, and this is definitely not a doing on your part. That is the whole beauty of it. This is because the me as the center, through the years of growing up, has always been blamed. The child has always been blamed by the parents. Don't do this. Don't do that. You see? So the me, which is the center, the ego with its sense of doership, is brought up with this conditioning that I am doing something wrong. And I use this example often, that if a young child, let's say, is running around the house and by accident drops something, an expensive curio or whatever, immediately the parent will berate the child and say, don't do that. Why are you being careless? You know, you are going to get punished. Now this child is being the child. The child has not assigned a value to the curio. The child cannot fathom what happened that I am suddenly guilty of a crime. You see, that is the child's conditioning. You did something and you are to blame because of that. We all grow up with this. In the Toltec tradition, it's called domestication. We get domesticated by our environment. Okay. Therefore, it becomes very easy for us to fall into this pattern where we blame ourselves. I should not have run and knocked that curio down. Why did I do that? Now, imagine a situation where the child is running around the house the next day and there are again 5-6 expensive curios lying around and the child doesn't knock any of them, right? The parent is not telling the child, oh, congratulations, you didn't knock any curio down. You see, it is expected that the child will not do that. So this is forced upon us, where then we start judging ourselves and blaming ourselves and less compassion arises for us. But the beauty of the teaching is that compassion, and after all, this was, you know, the Buddha's final teaching was on compassion. Okay. Compassion, when understood through the eyes of the teaching, is a felt oneness with being, which means that no matter what my past conditioning, how much I have blamed and judged myself, if deep down I truly accept that nobody, neither others nor myself, are the doers of their actions, then compassion arises not only for others but for oneself. Now, let me put it another way. If you feel compassion is arising as far as others are concerned, but not for yourself, there is an error there. Because if you feel compassion arising for others, in whom is that compassion arising? In Priyam only. Compassion is arising in Priyam only. So compassion is arising. It may appear that it is not arising, but it is arising. But because Priyam's conditioning, like most of us, is to be hard on oneself, to blame oneself, to judge oneself, it appears that Priyam has no compassion for herself. That is the illusion. That is the Maya. But deep down, we know, as within, so without. So compassion will arise. In fact, this teaching truly makes one accept that I am as God created me. I am as God created me. We also sometimes feel we don't deserve compassion. The ego feels, oh, you see, the ego is a very mischievous thing. It wants to be in control all the time. I should not be compassionate. I don't deserve to be compassionate. I don't deserve to be compassionate for myself because I've done so many wrong things. This is all based on doership. If the teaching of non-doership is understood and assimilated, which it is already happening, otherwise even compassion for others won't arise. It is an irreversible process, but one just has to allow. One just has to allow oneself to feel compassion for oneself. To allow that all my imperfections, my so-called imperfections, which I feel I have, were gifted by God. They were not my doing. And Maharaj said, true compassion is the refusal to suffer for imaginary reasons. And I can just add there, true compassion for myself is the refusal to suffer, psychological suffering, for reasons which I have imagined. And it will happen. It will happen. It is just hardwired conditioning that makes it take longer for us to feel compassionate for our own selves. But the fact that it is arising means it is already happening, and that process needs to be trusted. Therefore, as they say, love yourself till it hurts. Because you are precisely the way God made you. All your imperfections are perfectly placed. Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
sir. All right. So we can just sit in silence for a few minutes now. And I think I need help from one of the volunteers here to change the screen. Unless they've all fallen asleep because of a late Diwali night, that's also possible. I remember at Rameshji's satsangs, you know, if someone was dozing off like this during his talks, and others would get bugged because they'd see one head bobbing like this and bobbing like that. And he would say, oh, don't worry about him. He's in samadhi. But it does happen, you know. You find yourself dozing off, falling asleep. And that's actually the thinking mind. Priyam, I think everyone is forced to look at you. Is that right? Or is it only me? Anyway, it's a sweet face, so I don't think people will complain. And it's a break from just seeing me with my big nose also. So I think it's a good happening. All right. So I was saying that I have seen it quite often that even when my mother's post-lockdown weekly meditations would take place here in our living room, and even when I started giving talks, even before that, when my mother's guru would come, because, you know, the crowds were getting a bit bigger for him, and so we invited him to give his group meditations here. People would feel drowsy and tend to look like they are falling asleep. And you see, what is happening in many cases is that this heaviness, this burden of an active mind, when it is slowing down, is going to sleep, that is what happens. That is what happens. And an atmosphere and an environment of silence, sacred silence and space, enables that happening. Enables that happening. So it's quite a beautiful phenomenon as well. All right. So we'll just sit in silence for a few minutes. And I will just look at my WhatsApp before that to see if there's any information from the volunteers. Okay. They say it's fine and people can only see me. Except on Zoom, perhaps. All right. We might take a break for a couple of weeks. I'm not sure yet. It might happen. But if you are on the mailing list, then you will receive a notification of what's going to be happening. And there are a couple of talks which I would like to line up. I don't know also if it's going to happen smoothly, but one is with, as I've said before, when I had announced a joint talk with my mother, some questions had come in for her, three or four questions which we've chosen, which she'd like to speak about. Her path is the path of Shakti, the energy. It's a different approach, but everything leads to the same. And the other is this book I've spoken about, this the great saint Sri Anandamayima, and the author of that book, this beautiful lady, Swami Nityanand, who's a what I would call a fierce devotee of Ma, which is very rare to find. It would be nice to do a session with her, a brief session on Anandamayima. And she was with Anandamayima when she was a child. So that would be quite nice to have her also. We're going to work at that. And perhaps what will also happen is some silent meditations. And if that appeals to you all are welcome to be part of it. At Meher Baba's Samadhi in Ahmednagar, Meher Baba was a Parsi sage master in Maharashtra. Outside his Samadhi, there is a quotation of his: things that are real are given and received in silence. And if I'm not mistaken, Meher Baba didn't speak for the last 40 years of his life. Things that are real are given and received in silence. And that is true love. That silence is true love. Because in silence, there is no me and the other. That is true love. In dualistic love, there is me and the other.